This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I don't think they went out to vote for a party that was going to kind of slash and burn people that are working hard on behalf of residents, replace them for a party that is quite heavily moving to the right, you know, to pander to reform, possibly. I think that's what they're doing. To listen to an MP, particularly locally, that seems obsessed with small boats. I want them to talk about a lot more progressive policies that will really make people's lives better. And I just think that local people, particularly, and across the country, need to know what is happening within the Labour Party and why it is struggling so badly.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week where Nigel Farage swept into County Hall to visit the reform leadership at KCC, councillors in Dover voted for a new order to tackle antisocial behaviour, and Reform parted ways with its cabinet member for Highways and Transport. I'm senior news editor Nikki White, standing in for Simon Finlay, who's away this week, and I'm joined by local democracy reporter Dan Essen, who covers borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello.
And senior editor Matt Ramsden, who's taking a look at what's been happening with KCC this week.
Hello.
This week's special guest is Councillor Jamie Pout, who made the headlines in April when he was expelled from Labour over claims he used social media to support rival candidates. So, Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
So I got back into the weeds this week by going to Dover District Council's Cabinet as they voted to approve a new public spaces protection order. It covered all the usual stuff that councils use PSPOs for, like unauthorised camping, dog control, dog poo, that kind of thing. But the main topic of discussion was the rules on antisocial public drinking.
Any particular reason why they chose to do this?
So renewal of their PSPO has been on the cards for a while, as the current one is set to expire at the end of July. This new one's going to last another 3 years from the expiry of the current one. The council said that with regard to the rules on antisocial drinking, their reason backed up by a consultation and Kent Police data, which is why they've covered pretty much all of Dover, Deal and Woolmer, but left out places like Kersney and Sandwich. But obviously last month during the heatwave, there are a spate of incidents of drunken seaside disorder and violence in places like Broadstairs and across East Kent. So councillors tell me they think having strict PSPOs is a way to police that kind of thing before it happens.
But what do the rules actually allow the council or police to do?
I mean, basically, they allow police officers or authorised council officers to tell people who are drinking and engaging in antisocial behaviour in the areas covered to either hand over their booze or clear off out the area. In theory, if people refuse to do so, they get hit with a fine of £100, reduced to 75 if paid within 10 days. But legally, the maximum fine that can be issued for violating these kinds of rules is up to £1,000. Of course, that all depends on police and council officers actually seeing people and enforcing against that sort of behaviour, which depends on whether there's enough staff around. Though councillors at the meeting this week, where the extension was approved, were at pains to stress the rules are only going to be used against people who are drinking and being antisocial to others. So you can still have your glass of Prosecco on Deal Pier without fear of being harassed by the police.
Well, that's good news. Thanks, Dan. Matt, it's been a busy week at County Hall.
Yes, it has been, starting with a visit from Reform UK party leader Nigel Farage, who met with council leader Lyndon Kemp-Kerran and other members of the KCC cabinet.
So what was he doing in the county?
He's been touring reform-run councils across the country, and it was Kent's turn. We initially thought that he was going to be in the county for some major announcements regarding DOGE and some of the stuff it might have found in terms of spending efficiencies, but that wasn't the case.
So what did he have to say?
A lot, actually. He took aim at a number of issues, from local government reorganisation to trans books in libraries and the cost of paying for special needs pupils to be transported to school and back. He was particularly keen to talk about plans to abolish KCC and replace it and other Kent councils with a number of new unitary authorities. And he said reform might launch a consultation scheme to gauge the strength of feeling among the public to losing such an historic institution as KCC.
So how would that play out?
Well, if there was a groundswell of opinion that wanted KCC to remain, council chiefs could organise a referendum on the subject, where the great Kent public could have its say. I'm not sure the effect this would have on the government's decision, and I'm not sure council leader Lyndon Kemp-Kerran is on board with the idea either.
Why is that?
Well, she made the very valid point that a referendum would cost north of £1 million, and that's money she wouldn't want to spend at a time she's trying to find savings elsewhere. I'm not sure she was aware of Nigel Farage's thinking ahead of the comments.
So what else has been happening at KCC?
Another big development this week was Ashford Rural South Councillor Bill Barrett became the first member of the Cabinet to leave his position. He's been in charge of highways and transport for the past month, but he's gone. The whole thing has been presented as being amicable, and I guess we'll wait and see if that's true.
Thanks, Matt.
What have you been looking at this week, Nikki?
So I live in a village in the Tunbridge and Morling area, and a regular topic on our WhatsApp group is whether the postman has been or not. It might sound trivial, but every couple of weeks, someone will ask if anyone has seen the postie recently, as they've been expecting a letter and it hasn't arrived. Now, we're not just talking ordinary stuff. It's lots of like birthday cards, bank letters, and correspondence about vital health appointments have taken weeks to arrive or just don't seem to materialise at all. And now I think I know why.
Why is that? Too many dogs in the neighbourhood?
So we reported this week how people living in Tunbridge, Sevenoaks and Tunbridge Wells have been waiting up to 2 weeks to get their mail, and it's all after the launch of a trial scheme. Now, this pilot is meant to see first-class letters delivered every day from Monday to Saturday and second-class mail every other day from Monday to Friday. The pilot began in May at 37 delivery offices across the UK, and that includes ones in Tenterden and Tunbridge. But it seems it isn't working, and in fact, things seem to actually be worse than ever. And now Tunbridge Wells MP Mike Martin, Sevenoaks MP Laura Trott and Tunbridge MP Tom Tugendhat, they're calling on Royal Mail to scrap the trial after receiving complaints from thousands of constituents.
And has Royal Mail had anything to say in response to that?
Yeah, they have. They say the idea behind the scheme is to make things more efficient while protecting customer choice over things like price, speed and reliability. But they say these pilots are an important way to test how changes could work in practice. Now, they've admitted that it is early days, but they're getting what a spokesman described as valuable insight, and they're monitoring things closely. Now, it doesn't help that a recent report found that the TN postal area was already one of the worst performing regions in the country, with just 67% of first class mail being delivered on time between 2024 and March 2025. Now, to put that into some kind of context, Royal Mail has an on time target of 95% for this type of delivery. So the figures for that part of the county were already way off what they should be. There will be plenty of people hoping that the Royal Mail listens to our MPs and tries something new, as this pilot doesn't seem to be working.
Let's hope they listen to the feedback. Have you had your eye on anything else going on at Westminster?
Yeah, our listeners may remember our Blue Badge battle campaign to get temporary parking help for those who've got short-term illnesses. It's been backed by all the county's MPs, but Helen Grant, who's been on board from the start, she's managed to secure a debate at Westminster Hall, which is fantastic news, and we'll have more on that next week.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Our guest today was until relatively recently the deputy leader of Dover District Council, despite being in his first term as a district councillor. But in recent months, he's found himself expelled from his party in the midst of conflict with a local Labour MP. Councillor Jamie Pout joins us now. Jamie, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for joining us. Firstly, a bit of an obvious question, but how did you end up in politics and why did you join the Labour Party in particular?
For a long time, I've been very interested in injustices, I suppose, that people face and how I can help them out, I guess. I work in education. I often see people being pushed out or, you know, facing things that they really shouldn't be. And so as a trade unionist, I've always stood up for people, even when things don't affect me. I wouldn't say I necessarily enjoy arguing with people, but possibly it's something that's come naturally to me. So I've always tried to do my best where I can. I started off as a parish councillor in Aylsham, becoming the chair of parish council. And then I kind of felt that, you know, I had more to offer, which is why I stood to be a district councillor. Finding my way into the Labour Party, I suppose, if I'm completely honest, I joined during the Corbyn era, which I think a lot of people did. For the many, not the few, really resonated with me, having people hoarding wealth while other people are incredibly poor didn't sit well with me. And so, you know, I felt that I could support a party that was doing something about that.
Like I said, you were on Aylsham Parish Council and then you got elected to district council and very rapidly became the deputy leader of district council. Obviously, that's a lot of responsibility to balance with having a full-time job. What was that like?
Yeah, it was great, actually. Really enjoyable. I think I was quite fundamental to the campaign when we won the council. in May 23, I ran a lot of the campaign. I made the leaflets. I did a lot of social media. I was out every single weekend, even though I had a very young family. And so I'm very grateful that my family is very supportive of what I do. So I think it was only fair, I suppose, that the leader, Kevin Mills, put his faith in me to be his deputy. I think we worked very well together. We kind of bounced off each other. We had different strengths, different weaknesses. And so we worked very well. I guess it's fairly unheard of to have someone so young, so new in their political career, having just been elected to get on the cabinet, but not just that, to be the deputy leader. So I did find it took up a lot of my time. I do have a job as well, which I think is great. Or it was great in that group of people, that Labour group, that a lot of us had jobs. And so we could see things from a different point of view. You know, we weren't all just retired members. We were people that do a whole range of jobs. You know, I'm a teacher. I teach still. I go into lots of schools at the moment. I'm a trade unionist. And so, you know, sharing experiences with other people who are in the care sector, people who do all sorts of different jobs was fairly rewarding, I found.
In April, you were expelled from the Labour Party, the party you've been a member of for some years. Take us through how that took place.
This is quite a long history, but I wasn't necessarily aware that anything was going on. And I guess that's the most frustrating thing, that I thought this was going to be absolutely fantastic. I thought having a Labour district council and a Labour MP with a Labour government was going to be absolutely fantastic for this area. We would get lots of support. We'd be able to do absolutely fantastic things for the people of Dover and Deal, the constituency, the district. This was going to be a monumental period of time for local people. But what's transpired, I suppose, is that from as far back as March 2022, when I was having some exchanges with Mike Tapp on Twitter, I had some exchanges then, just, you know, pleasantries. He was trying to get elected or selected even as the candidate for Dover and Deal for Labour. He messaged me on Twitter. He messaged on another Twitter account. So I have two Twitter accounts. I was trying to keep politics and education separate at the time. It turns out then in December 2024, he made a complaint to the Labour Party, essentially alleging that I ran a Twitter account that supported independent candidates. I could prove that that Twitter account was not mine. And actually, the person who owned that Twitter account came forward, provided a statement to the Labour Party to say that they owned that account. No one else had ever had access to it. But the Labour Party decided that on the balance of probabilities that it was mine. And so I was expelled on the 29th of April. And that was it. I'm no longer in the Labour Party. As a consequence of that, then at the Dover District Council's annual general meeting in May, I was removed as the deputy leader. And so I find myself now as an independent councillor. Mm.
And just for the benefit of listeners, obviously, I have to say this as Mike Tapp himself isn't here. But when I covered this story when it initially happened in April, Mike Tapp did not respond to my question about whether he specifically made the report against you, though he did comment saying that as a former Labour member, of course, you'd be critical of the party. And the individual you mentioned, Angie Ray, did indeed also tell me that she ran this Twitter account, not you.
Yeah. And of course, you know, he can say that obviously I'm going to be bitter about the party. Yeah, that's fine. And he can claim that he didn't make those allegations. But I'm happy to share the report that was put to me with anyone that wants to see it. One person provided evidence and one person only provided evidence, and that was Mike Tapp. And so someone else might have made the allegation, but that person was never shared with me. Mike Tapp's evidence is the only one that appears in the allegation. And so, you know, I think it's safe to assume that that has come from him.
I assumed, and I think most people would assume, that this was a straightforward factional knife fight. Mike Tapp is, in the eyes of most, very firmly on the right of the Labour Party. He was, you know, he used to work for the MP John Speller, who's a sort of a veteran of what's called the old Labour right. And obviously, like you said earlier, you joined during the Corbyn years, so were very much on the left of the party. You know, why do you think he spent his time seemingly trying to get you kicked from the party?
Yeah, he used to work for Rosie Duffield as well, but I don't think he widely promotes that. Yeah, firmly on the Labour right, I would suggest. And I think recently he was on Radio 5 Live and described as snarling at anyone on the left wing. And again, I find that absolutely amazing that we would have Labour MPs snarling at people described as left wing. And I'm happy to be firmly on the left of any political spectrum. Because, you know, this is an individual that claims that the Labour Party is not the party of welfare. And so if that's the case, then I think I'm quite happy being on the outside of the Labour Party as it stands, because it's not going in a direction that I would support in any way, shape or form. One of the allegations that he also included was that I threatened a Labour minister. And this came about because I was meeting regularly with Baroness Hayman, who is the minister responsible for port health. Yeah, that is true. I was meeting with her. I did not threaten her, and Labour didn't even investigate that allegation. So that's, you know, very odd from his point of view. I was messaging her on WhatsApp privately, and for some reason, you know, he's come up with the conclusion that I was threatening her. What was actually happening was, you know, when the Conservatives were in control, I was dealing with Lord Bennion. He was the Minister for Port Health, and I was quite firmly pressing them that the funding they were providing for Dover Port Health Authority to secure this country's biosecurity was not sufficient for us down in Dover, and we needed more money. Subsequently, we received £3.1 million to provide that service. You know, again, when Labour came in, we were led to believe by people like Steve Reed and Dan Zeichner that we would receive better services. And when that didn't happen, I felt obliged on behalf of the people of the Dover district to keep pressing them. If that is me threatening ministers, then I think we have very different views on what is threatening behaviour. I was simply pressing a minister in charge of a portfolio on what I thought was subpar. And so, you know, if a Labour councillor pressing a Labour government gets them chucked out of the party, I think we're in a really sorry state of affairs.
Since your expulsion from the party, there's a crowdfunder, and you know, you've instructed solicitors which you intend to help you appeal against the decision of the Labour Party. But I guess your question is, since you're very critical of the Labour Party, why even bother? Do you want to be readmitted to the Labour Party if it is, you know, as you've described it?
Well, yeah, why even bother is a great question. Because, you know, as I said right at the start, I have a strong sense of justice. And right now, this doesn't feel like justice has been served. I can quite easily demonstrate, I never posted those things on Twitter to support an independent candidate. And, you know, let's be frank, is that the worst thing in the world when someone in politics says that someone else in politics is doing a great job and you should support them? And by the way, these candidates were not in this constituency, they were elsewhere in the country. And so, I mean, is that the worst?
It is a violation of party rules, though. If you put it, any opposing candidate, even if they're not in
absolutely. But is it the worst thing in the world that you say this person is doing a really great job? It's not really, is it? Politics needs to be a little bit kinder across the board. But I have a strong sense of justice, and what has happened here is totally unfair and is totally wrong. And it's commensurate of what the Labour Party is doing to large swathes of people. And I just think it's worthwhile highlighting to people what is going on in the Labour Party. I don't think this is what people voted for when they went out in the general election. I don't think they went out to vote for a party that was going to kind of slash and burn people that are working hard on behalf of residents and replace them for a party that is quite heavily moving to the right, to pander to reform, possibly. I think that's what they're doing. To listen to an MP, particularly locally, that seems obsessed with small boats, I want them to talk about a lot more progressive policies that will really make people's lives better. And I just think that local people particularly and across the country need to know what is happening within the Labour Party and why it is struggling so badly.
So only last week, actually, MP for Coventry South, Zara Sultana, announced that she and the former Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, are going to be the inaugural leaders of some form of new left party in the very near future. Is that the kind of party you'd be interested in joining? And do you think others locally might? Because obviously several other Labour councillors resigned in solidarity with you when you were expelled.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting, isn't it? It's exciting to see that there is a movement towards the left. If you've got the Labour Party that is now firmly in the centre, arguably centre-right, you're definitely going to open up a space for people who want to see progressive politics, you know, who want to see the use of food banks decreasing rather than increasing, who want to see things like buses being addressed, who want to see nationalisation of, water utilities, of energy, of large national infrastructure. I think it's exciting to see that people are rallying together and saying, actually, we don't have to rely on a party that is shifting away from kind of our core values. Where I see myself in the future, I don't know. I'm quite happy as I am, as an independent councillor. Tonight will be the first, proper full council meeting for me as an independent group leader. So I don't know what the future holds right now, but I will keep, fighting those fights that I have been taking to the government on port health, Southern Water are pumping into the sea in Deal at the moment, which they haven't done for a while. So we have to fight that fight. I want people's bills to come down. I want people to have a better life than they have done previously. So I will keep fighting that fight. Exactly what that will look like for me in the future, I just don't know. But I'm very thankful to the two cabinet colleagues, Councillor Blair and Councillor Zoster, who resigned in solidarity with me. I'm grateful that there are people that, have morals and they stick to them out there in politics. But, it really is good to see people, wanting to see fair policies on the left of politics.
And my last question is, do you think Labour is going to win the next general election, and would you even want them to?
Yeah, that's a really good question, isn't it? We're a long way from an election, aren't we? And a lot could happen in that time. Would I want them to win? Well, I certainly wouldn't want Reform to win. I would be really concerned, particularly as a trade unionist, to see Nigel Farage as Prime Minister. I would be really concerned to see some of the policies of the right wing being enacted nationwide. Here in Kent, we've got a Reform Council. I'm really concerned about what they're going to do to people's rights. When we're worrying about flags and the location of library books, when there are so many more important things that will tangibly improve people's day-to-day lives, that's we're really looking at the wrong things there. And so I would worry about Reform taking control. So, an alternative, absolutely, I'd want an alternative to that. But if this is the direction that Labour are going, then I would have to think carefully about, where my vote would go, that's for sure.
Councillor Jane Pout, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
As I mentioned earlier, Nigel Farage was in the county this week speaking about a number of issues, including the emotive subject of using taxes to take children with special needs to school and back. According to him, this has got totally out of hand in Kent, with KCC having to pay almost £100 million a year to provide the service. Nikki, is this a vital service or too much of a strain on the public finances?
It is a vital service, but it's a massive strain. Of course it is. And Nigel Farage is right to question it. I mean, £98 million is a huge sum. And if we're looking at every penny to save money, we've got to explore every avenue to find ways of making those savings. We've all heard of cases where parents spend years, they're just fighting to get send provision for their child, and then only to find out that the best teaching is at a school either at the other end of the county or even a completely different county. And that's not good for anybody. I mean, the child may get the education that they need and deserve, but then they're knackered from an extremely long day travelling to and fro, with sometimes trips of an hour, 2 hours either end of a school day. The parents are also faced with a logistical nightmare of school runs, and that's made even worse if they have other children that they need to look after too. And then you've got the authority that's been left with a huge transport bill. Now, I think the authorities, they face an impossible dilemma. They have a legal obligation to provide a child with an education and get them there. So if they do fork out for a specialist teacher, they've got to make that decision. Do you have the specialist teacher on the child's doorstep, or do you then foot the bill to take the child to where the teaching is available if that is miles away from home? I think Nigel Farage is right. There's got to be savings to be made, but I just don't think it's going to be the massive figures that are going to need you to make a decent saving. I mean, what do you think, Dan?
Part of the reason it's so expensive is that the demand has massively expanded, but also it's the amount that councils pay for any individual journey under the sort of special educational needs transport to school programme is well above the odds what you would pay as a regular member of the public for journeys of approximately the same kind of distance and time of day. Part of the reason for that is it's a story common to all government, you know, national and local government outsourcing, where essentially the government has a legal responsibility to provide some kind of service. They don't have the capacity or means or will to provide it themselves, so they have to go to the private sector to do it. There's a limited amount of actors in the private sector who are able to provide that service. So they're essentially able to corner the market. A taxi company comes to a local council and says, you've got 20 kids locally who need to go to school every morning because they, you know, have special needs and don't want to get on the bus or that kind of thing. I've got 20 taxi drivers who are available at 8 o'clock every morning. You're going to pay me whatever I ask for it. So essentially, I think it's pretty much an open secret that local councils get fleeced by private taxi companies on the cost for these things, which it probably would end up being cheaper if parents literally paid for a taxi to send the kid themselves. But because it's managed through the council and through the system of outsourcing, it ends up being horrendously expensive for something which really shouldn't be. And the other part of it is that demand has massively expanded. Everyone knows there's a huge waiting list for educational healthcare plans, which are what entitle children to an official recognition of their special educational needs and disabilities. And in the past 5 to 10 years, the amount of children with those healthcare plans and thus entitled to extra support, like a lift to school, has grown exponentially. There's a huge waiting list of people who want to be officially registered as such. And for good reason, you know, as a parent with limited time and money, a child who might need some sort of support, why wouldn't you try to apply for it? But eventually what that means is that local councils are paying huge amounts of money to transport loads of children to school, some of which I think a lot of people would probably agree aren't necessarily in as much need as others.
But going back to Farage's point here, I mean, there will be a lot of people in Kent who will agree with him, and their argument will be, why should I pay my taxes so £100 million is spent on and taking other people's kids to school? What would you say to that, Nikki?
A child needs to get to school, and I think the difficulty is that particularly with SEND children, they're not always able to go to the school that is closest to them or is the most suitable place. Now, a parent with a SEND child is probably not going to be in the highest paid job anyway, so doesn't have much disposable income because their time is devoted to looking after that child. But equally, why should your child suffer because you can't get them to school? It's not a decision that I would want to be making. I think it's really hard. I think the authorities are caught between a rock and a hard place. Is it down to a parent to get their child to school? It is down to a parent to get their child to school in terms of making sure that they turn up every single day to fill that place. But how they get them there shouldn't necessarily hit their pocket if that means that the person who is going to be the best teacher is at the other end of the county. You know, you're living in Dartford, the best teaching is in Dover. If that's what's suitable for your child, then the transport needs to be in place. Now, okay, you could argue that you might want to move the child and move the whole family. But what if you have two children with special needs? You know, do you live in the middle of the county and then take one in one direction and one in the other? It's just not feasible.
It's a very difficult debate. Dan, you talk about how the councils are over a barrel at times, where firms will come along and say, we'll give you the service, here's a price, take it or leave it. But I mean, the whole policy of transporting kids to school has grown massively in recent years. Why is it just taken off so much?
It depends who you ask, essentially. But like I said, it's no secret that the amount of children who are officially registered having special educational needs has hugely expanded in the past 5-10 years. And some of those children will be entitled to transport to school, because it's important to say it depends largely on their parents' circumstances. You know, if you have a child who has special educational needs, but the parents are perfectly capable of getting them to and from the relevant educational institution, you don't just get it if you ask for it. You do have to hit criteria for it. I guess it's a much more difficult and, I guess, philosophical question about why is the rate of children who have real or perceived special educational needs increasing. And I think there's an argument to be made that these things are not illnesses which drop out of the sky by random chance, like things like cancer. They are in part conditioned by the world around them. And it shows in that, for example, diagnosis of special educational needs are significantly more prevalent in people of lower socioeconomic backgrounds. Essentially, the poorer you are, the worse your life circumstances, the more likely you are to be diagnosed with special educational needs. So it's sort of at the confluence of decades and decades of social and educational and economic problems that have led to what we see now, which is, councils with a constant backlog of parents who quite rightly say they need support with their children.
Okay, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Dan and Matt for their contributions, and to special guest Jamie Powell. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. And you can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.